Hi, this is Leonard Lopate. You're listening to WNYC On Demand. Podcasts, streaming, and MP3 downloads available when you want to listen at WNYC.org and iTunes.
WNYC On Demand is supported by DataPipe Managed Hosting Services, providing application management, hosting, professional services, security services, and compliance solutions for mid-market and Fortune 1000 enterprises. DataPipe.com.
You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Until recently, the brain was thought to work something like a machine with different areas doing different things. One section controlling speech, another devoted to thought. But now scientists are beginning to believe that the areas of the brain can multitask. In the brain that changes itself, stories of personal triumph from the frontiers of brain science. Dr. Norman Doidge describes these advancements and the patients who are benefiting from them. His book is published by Viking. I'm very pleased it has brought Dr. Norman Doidge to my show today. Hello.
Thank you for having me.
How did doctors come to think of the brain as something of a machine or a computer in the first place?
At the beginning of modern science, there was a great deal of dissatisfaction with the previous view of the brain or the previous view of the human body, which saw it as rather mystical. And with the discoveries of Galileo, who began to explain the universe according to mechanical laws of movement, scientists became smitten with the idea of explaining our own bodies, including the heart, mechanically, which was a great triumph, but also the brain as a kind of complex pump.
But we wind up with words like hardwired, for example, which I associate with computers. For a while, we had this computer model that we were working from.
Yeah, well, the computer model is still very much with us in many quarters, and the notion of hardwiring, that's just the latest version of the machine-like brain.
But aren't different areas of the brain primarily given over to specific tasks?
In the course of a human life, various areas of the brain get assigned to perform specific tasks.
So it's different in different people based on their experience?
To some degree, it actually is different in different people. And the scientists who were champions of the notion of the machine-like brain ignored those important differences and developed maps of the brain, which in fact turn out not to be as accurate as we thought.
And in some cases, a person can have a stroke and lose speech, and another person can have a stroke in pretty much the same area and not lose speech.
Depending on your handedness and when you acquired language, the speech area may move around a little bit. It was originally thought to be in the left part of the brain, but that turns out not always to be true.
Other parts of the body can be trained to adapt or compensate. Why did the medical community think that the brain couldn't?
Several reasons. One, it was the brain was just so complicated; it was overwhelming to begin to form the accurate maps as to what was done where. And we also lack the technology to really investigate it till very recently. It requires the ability to make microscopic movies, if you will, to see these parts of these functions in the brain moving around within the brain architecture or anatomy.
So brain scans weren't enough to figure all of that out?
Some brain scans, in fact, were not enough because an individual neuron fires very, very quickly, and those would capture thousands and thousands of neurons firing. So at first, they were not enough. Now we've learned how to accommodate brain scans to show gross movements of mental functions.
So what is neuroplasticity? Plasticity suggests that there's a certain malleability to the neurons.
There's malleability in the brain and nervous system at many different levels. There's malleability within the cells. Neurons or the nerve cells in the brain form connections with other neurons, and we now know that those connections can change. When you learn something, you can go from having perhaps 1,300 connections in one neuron to the next to 2,700. We know that the genes are turned on and off by our thoughts within the neurons, which change the structure. Then there are departments of the brain, and these can also change.
What I remembered, and it wasn't all that long ago, about all of this, talking to doctors, the brain developed through childhood, and at a certain point it pretty much stopped. A little later we heard that, well, maybe it started, it picked up development again during adolescence and reshaped itself. And then from then on it was pretty much set, minor adjustments, and you just started deteriorating from that moment on.
That's exactly right. And I once wrote an article called Develop Till You Drop, making fun of people who thought that development could go on later in life until I understood how plasticity works. Look, there is some slowing of development. It's a good question as to why we didn't detect it. One reason is, yes, there is some slowing. We go through what are called critical periods of plasticity early in life when there is an incredible amount of plasticity. Then people to a degree go their own way, and I guess because development becomes so idiosyncratic, it's hard to talk about it in easily recognized stages. But the other thing is that we didn't understand how to facilitate development until we cracked, you know, the laws of neuroplasticity. And having done so...
And how have you done so?
Well, a lot of it was done by experimentation on animals, seeing one of the great, perhaps the greatest living neuroplastician in this area is Dr. Michael Merzenich, and he worked with rats and mostly monkeys, actually, and would train them to learn new activities or sounds that were thought to have been in monkeys that were past their prime, or change their brain maps by doing very, very careful, repetitive, incremental increases of various activities. And he would just basically map their brains as they did things, you know, thousands of times and show that the brain maps could be altered.
My guest is Dr. Norman Doidge, D-O-I-D-G-E, of Columbia University Center for Psychoanalytic Training and Research, and also the University of Toronto's Department of Psychiatry. He's written a book called The Brain That Changes Itself, Stories of Personal Triumph from the Frontiers of Brain Science. It's published by Viking. Dr. Merzenich also used plasticity to understand autism, didn't he?
Yes. Many of the great discoveries in plasticity I found over the course of this book were accidental. They're accidental because the scientists accepted the doctrine that the brain didn't change and they fell into them. The discovery that plastic change could occur in autistic children actually occurred because he had developed a program with Paula Talal and others, which was to treat learning disabilities, particularly language disabilities and dyslexias. And that program by Scientific Learning is quite remarkable, and it was given to many, many children. It turns out that kids with autism often have learning disorders, so they too were given the program. And lo and behold, reports started coming back to Merzenich that children with autism started to show an explosion of communication and language skills, and but also to be much more socially connected with their parents and families. And so now they're developing a program specifically for kids with autism.
And not just kids, at least I'm not talking about a program, but Temple Grandin is a very famous autistic writer and scientist, has been on the show a number of times. And the first time I saw her, which had to be about a dozen years ago or so, she had a much more difficult time communicating than she has in more recent years, and she's a woman in her 50s. So it's obvious that the brain's plasticity continues into older years, even if it does slow down.
Yeah, that is.
Well, maybe it's more for autistics because they have more rewiring that they can do.
No, it continues for everybody, and this is one of the most important findings. It's plasticity exists from cradle to grave. Another reason we didn't pick it up, and this is, the contribution I think I make in this book is because neuroplasticity is a property of the brain, but it can give rise both to flexibilities of behavior and rigidities of behavior. The metaphor for this is that plasticity is like snow on a mountain. Because the snow's pliable, if you want to ski down the mountain, you can go take many different paths. That's plasticity. But because it's pliable, if you keep taking the same path, you get stuck in tracks. And most of us in the course of our lives get stuck in tracks or grooved in. And this, in fact, masks our inherent plasticity. And because neuroscientists basically were arguing the brain was not plastic, our whole view of old age has been somewhat distorted by the notion that we get caught in, that we're much less flexible than we really are.
Well, we talk about our senior moments when we can't remember things. Some people suggest that it's really a matter of you use it or you lose it. Does the brain jettison things as well as part of this?
Yes.
This plasticity?
Yes. There are two kinds of plasticity. There's the plasticity which allows the brain to grow in certain areas, which is additive. But there's also a subtractive plasticity. And if you think about it, it's a good thing in many respects for the brain not to keep cortical real estate active for tasks we're not using. It's a use it or lose it brain. And in adolescence, we prune back a lot of our neurons for things we're not using. And it's thought that we do this just so that the brain stays efficient. If we're always keeping the lights on in buildings that are not active, it's a waste of energy.
Well, also adding stuff all the time, experience, knowledge. So I guess we get rid of all of those things that we no longer need to draw upon, although there are people who remember pretty much everything they learned in school and everything they learned since. So that would suggest that their brains are more plastic?
I don't know. I think you'd have to do a really close analysis to me. Certainly there are we have salient memories that people retain, and some people have better memories than others. But I'm not sure it's the case that everyone's retaining everything they ever learned. I suspect that they're doing a very effective pruning operation that leaves us very impressed by what they choose to retain.
Now, there's one of the key figures in all of this is Paul Bakirita.
Mm-hmm.
He was one of the first people to reject the idea of localization.
Yeah, I mean, localizationism, the idea that every function has a particular part, has been around for several hundred years, and it's in some respects one of the most important findings of neuroscience. But there were dissenting views from the very beginning.
Was based on watching his father recover from a stroke.
Yeah, and being a genius at the same time. But basically, I would say that of his generation, he was the first of his generation to really make the case that plasticity in the brain exists and the brain is changeable.
And he devised a machine in 1969 that could help congenitally blind people see. And is that based on the idea of neuroplasticity?
Totally. Because he had a sense of plasticity, he thought that if a certain certain perceptual function was lost, perhaps you could reroute it into the brain. And so he published this article about treating these people. It seemed like a very sci-fi kind of thing, very fantastic. But yes, back then, he was able to show that people using a camera that was attached to little vibrating pixel-like things on the back allowed people who had been congenitally blind to do some reading, to spot Twiggy, the anorexic supermodel, to say the telephone, that's a telephone I see, and it's obscured by a vase, and actually even to detect looming objects in perspective.
And yet much of that work was ignored. Why?
It was ignored because of the doctrine of the unchanging brain. It was simply inexplicable according to that doctrine. And so it was overlooked or doubted.
What about cochlear implants? Do they rely on the brain's plasticity?
Yeah, absolutely. A cochlear implant's not like a hearing aid. A hearing aid is for a person who has some hearing. But for people who have no hearing whatsoever, you need the cochlear implant is a device which replaces 3,000 hair cells in the hearing apparatus, and it's much, much simpler than those 3,000 hair cells, and yet it can still decode human speech. And the reason it can is because the brain is plastic enough to modify itself to this new kind of simpler input.
Other devices that Bakirita developed have used sensors placed on the tongue. Is the tongue a particularly sensitive area?
there's no dead skin to speak of on the tongue, which makes it especially sensitive, and it turns out to be a great substitute kind of portal of entry for data coming into the brain.
My guest is Dr. Norman Doidge. He's written a book called The Brain That Changes Itself, Stories of Personal Triumph from the Frontiers of Brain Science. Can neuroplasticity explain why habits, both good and bad, become ingrained?
Yes. It's a use-it-or-lose-it brain, and plasticity, as Merzenich has shown, is competitive. So once you develop a particular activity, it becomes the preferred way of doing something. So, basically, the plasticity is showing that the brain is really it's a habit-forming organ. This is something that Aristotle basically understood with his emphasis on habituation. It's been a theme all the way through to Tolstoy, who emphasized it. Yeah, we form habits, and the brain, we form habits and repeat things because plasticity is competitive, and once we get that way of doing it, it's like the tracks in the down the mountain.
But then there are people who work to overcome some of those habits, whether it's people who fight addictions or stop doing neurotic things later in their lives. That's happened with a lot of people. You would have assumed that somebody would have linked it to changes in the way the brain worked.
You would have, but the problem is that the greatest initial neuroscientist was Descartes, and he was the one who argued that our mental life is made of two different substances, the mind, which was a certain kind of substance, and a different kind of substance, which was the brain, and this is the mind-brain, the famous mind-brain split, and so people often thought the mind was plastic. But the brain, which was made of matter, was thought to be more machine-like and therefore unchangeable.
Just a mess of neurons.
A mess of neurons, but an inanimate mess of neurons.
So how does the idea of neuroplasticity affect medical specialties besides neurology and psychology? Is this an area that's being embraced by the medical community?
I think that it's just beginning to be embraced by the neuroscientists. I mean, in the book, I document a number of different kinds of cures that have been shown. But I don't think it's yet been totally embraced because it's something you have to think through. If we've had this notion of the brain as being very static, it's affected not just neuroscience, it's affected education, culture, how people immigrate and get acculturated, our whole overall view of human nature. So once you're liberated from that, you can begin to think through how it might affect other things. I think that other areas where there's been a kind of non-conscious awareness that you can just work for change include things like aspects of sports and personal training and things like that, where people are always speaking of, learning and muscle memory and have an innate sense that there can be some alterations there.
And they work with a certain attitude. They begin with a certain attitude. Is that important for the person who's trying to exercise that neuroplasticity?
It's absolutely essential for several reasons. First of all, neuroplastic effects are not immediate. They take place over time, so persistence is key. You have to know that what you're doing is not pointless. And if you're training yourself to do something new, you have to do basically two things always. You have to stop doing the problematic habit. You've got to constrain that. And then you've got to incrementally increase the brain areas. And you've got to go slow enough so that it's just like a workout. If you aim to lift too much weight at once, you're going to fail.
Are we creating new dendrites in the process? Is that what we're doing, creating new connections between
yes,
nerves?
Yes, we are creating new connections. And now we can show this microscopically. And it's massive, as I said before. You can go from 1,300. The changes take place at many levels. There's more neurotransmitters, which are the chemical messengers between nerves. There's actually a bulking up of the neurons. There's greater blood supply in the area. There's greater... And so, Yes, and there's a lot of change. Dendrites are branches between neurons, and these are enhanced as well.
Can neuroplasticity be useful for people who have normal brain function?
Yeah, and this is particularly heartening. First of all, the notion of normal brain functioning, we all have strengths and weaknesses. And
we're all a bit weird.
Okay. We all have
weird, well, at least the people I know.
We all have weird parts. And some of these parts are basically just under-functioning in our brains, and they're leading us. If you have a bottleneck in your brain, one area is weak. There are other areas which are strong that you can't have access to. And so, yes, you can, if you can properly diagnose what those weak areas are, you can strengthen them. But really what's most heartening is the treatments that are already out there to help people who are older preserve their brain, not only preserve their brains, but actually reverse a certain amount of memory loss. So Merzenich has worked with people at Posit Science, and they've taken people who are 80-year-olds and gotten them to function like they were 60-year-olds, and in a few cases like 50-year-olds with their memories. And this is really very remarkable.
But it would also require everybody getting on board for this to really work. And it's my sense from what you've been saying that while portions of the medical and psychological community have bought into this, not everybody has.
No, actually, I think that people who have we're at a funny moment in history where I think that the people who have looked at it now accept it. When I said it hasn't, I think the issue now is to begin to integrate this revolutionary idea. It can't be done all at once. You have to look at your own field and think, okay, if the brain changes, how would that affect my field and what I do? And that kind of thinking is just beginning right now. So while if you asked me about this 5 years ago, I would say that it was still controversial. In the year 2000, Eric Kandel from Columbia University won the Nobel Prize for showing that learning changes brain connections. And it's now becoming mainstream. But that means there's a lot of work to do still to integrate it.
I want to thank you so much for being with us. Dr. Norman Doidge is a research psychiatrist and psychoanalyst on the faculty at the Columbia University Psychoanalytic Center in New York and at the University of Toronto Department of Psychiatry. He has received 4 National Magazine Gold Awards in Canada, including one that challenged and written articles, including one that challenged the ideas he now espouses in his new book, Well, You Know Your Brain is Plastic.
Thank you.
And the book is called The Brain That Changes Itself, Stories of Personal Triumph from the Frontiers of Brain Science. It is published by Viking. Thanks for listening to WNYC On Demand. Please check out the other programs at WNYC.org or on iTunes. This is a free service made available by our listeners. Become a member of WNYC today.